Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
When you have some degree of success and fame, you know, that it defines you very much. You know, I'm the drummer in Bauhaus, and we're a great effing band, and we're unique, and we've broken down barriers, and you know, it was so exciting and so great, and just to be, and it was so creative, and all the rest that goes with it. And then suddenly, you know, it ends, and you're like, so I think I was a bit kind of head in the clouds.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
And so, without further ado, let's welcome back. We were mid-discussion with our good friend Kevin Haskins of Bauhaus, and there's many more besides, but we'll stay with Bauhaus. Anyway, that's precisely what we're talking about, isn't it, Lol? The early days?
Yeah, we're getting to the point of talking about, you know, when you start a band and things start to happen and you start to be good and people start to like you and you kind of lose yourself in that kind of situation for a while.
Kevin, for you, does it ring true, that notion of losing yourself when you were a young man starting off in the band?
Oh yeah, I mean, I took on a role which, in retrospect, was quite subservient. Actually, my dad had a Super 8 movie camera, and I filmed some stuff, and I had it digitized not long ago, and it was on a European tour, and I looked like a little baby, you know, and I was kind of, I must have been like 20 years old, but I looked like, right, I was, you know, 6 years old, and just like, it was very different person. And you know, the other guys would, they never stopped talking. So in the interviews, I would hardly talk at all.
You would sit there. You would be the quiet person.
Yeah. And one time I did speak up. I was reprimanded. And I'm actually having a physical reaction to it now. I read about it in a book.
Right.
I don't want to get too specific. And when I read about that moment, I had this physical reaction, and I buried it. Really was very hurtful to me, and I buried that. And it wasn't until I read it in a book somebody wrote that I remembered it. And I can very much relate to how, you know, the roles that you take on and fall into, and how much you're allowed to say. And but then during the 90s, I think I started to like change and become more assertive, and very much, and like it's been up to now, I'm, you know, I know a lot more about relationships and, you know, boundaries and, you know, what rights one has, in, you know, in relationships. And so I can conduct myself in a different manner now.
Right.
It's tough because we have the disadvantage, or it could be the aid memoir of, the internet. As I've come across, okay, there's a piece, MTV used to have this thing called 120 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the band sits there for 2 hours talking about questions and themselves and what they're doing. I sat for 120 minutes without saying a word. I have on occasion looked back to see if I do utter anything in 120 minutes. Right. No. And I'm sitting there trying to look nonchalant, not bored, and anxious, and involved, and intelligent, and like I've got a contribution to make, but I couldn't find a word to add to what was. It was all directed in one direction, and I couldn't really find a way in, and it's painful to watch.
You're very eloquent. You're a very eloquent chap with a good command of English language.
Yeah.
Do you know why you felt that way? Or
it's because I can only put it down to that day. I was feeling particularly, I wouldn't say out of sorts. I didn't look like I was worse for wear. Absolutely, and you would never see me that way. Because if I was feeling bad, I would look better than anybody. Make sure that when I appeared, I wouldn't be wearing black shades like Ray-Ban Wayfarers. Uh-huh. I'd have the eyes on show, you know. I'd be really smartly dressed in some kind of suit that I'd picked up. And that was a good outward sign that inwardly I was feeling like a little shaky. And sometimes I'd just be really, I get like screen fright, like camera shy. You get very self-conscious, and it just the only thoughts going through my mind were nothing to do with what was being said in this discussion or question and answer session. It would just be, have I got my best side? Do I look okay? Do you think people will know that my leg is shaking? Or nonsense. And so you have that extreme, and then I see a younger version of me backstage at the Paradiso in Amsterdam with John McGeoch and Severin post-gig. Susie's being very kind of, somehow she's just, all the answers to the questions being at her, she's like batting them away as insignificant. She's being very cynical, and it's very humorous. Mm. And I look like somebody,
I've seen
and I'm walking around going, somebody just like burst the tires in our van, I'm going to get them.
Oh yeah, I've seen that one, yeah.
I'm thinking, who is that? Yeah. Is that and Severin and McGeoch are kind of really mellow in the background and really not speaking and very kind of understated. And so I see two different me's from two different parts of my role in that band. Mm. And it's really freaky, you know, to, I don't recognize either of those two characters, and they're both me.
Yeah.
And you know that there's some recordings of the last Banshee shows.
Yeah.
And I would be scared to look at them thinking, God, I must have played like so badly, you know. I must have been, because that was like the pits for me.
Right.
And there I am on stage in Sao Paulo, or maybe it was in Buenos Aires, because we went down to Argentina.
Yeah.
Just before we left for go back to England. And I was at the top of my game. There was not a beat dropped. It was my kit. We'd taken my drums all that way. We used to, so we did it correctly. And my mind would tell me it must have been bad. And I'm looking at it almost in disbelief, thinking, wow. Well, we'd been gigging a long time, and I'd been in that position for a long time. So isn't it funny? It's that I can actually see, we can see ourselves and not really recognize ourselves, and we can see the truth and not really believe it.
Yes.
What is the truth? What is it? It seems it's all conditional on how we feel when we talk about it or view it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head there, because I recognize myself in that 100%, what you just said, because it's, you know, we've all been in bands where we've had very charismatic, powerful front people, you know, and when you start off, everybody's all doing the same thing together and we're all in it together. But then gradually over time, you know, the press and the audience and the way things go, and just the way people think about front people anyway, it tends to change relationships in a way that's not always beneficial. And then, you know, because we're with each other 24/7 in a situation like that, we start to take some of that on board, and it becomes, you know, I used to wonder why bands, you know, at the top of their game would break up or things would go wrong and that. And I understand now completely why, because it's a very unreal situation to put most people in, especially at a point where you're maturing as a human being. But when we were going through those changes, we didn't have the benefit of therapy or you know, any kinds of other understanding. We were just like, oh my god, I got to get on with it and do whatever I can to survive. And the really good thing about being a little older and being able to reflect back and write about it is you see the truth, you absolutely see it for what it is, and you have to be authentic. Because I had a lot of for want of a better word, angst about the whole of my 20s and what went on and how it went on. And I don't anymore.
No.
I don't. It's free. And I mean, you know, this here, the three of us sitting here chatting about it, is an example of why it works. Because it's open, it's vulnerable, but it's also the truth, you know? And that's what we need. It will set you free.
The audience can see it as well, as you say. They'll sniff it out.
Oh yeah.
They'll still sense what's going on that stage, no matter how we try to disguise it. If somebody's having a bad night, the audience goes, that, whoever it may be, they're in a funny mood. There's something weird going on there.
Right.
So how did your role affect? Because you're still back. I mean, you don't have to go into how things are today, but there was certain points where you were saying in your band, Kevin, you adopted a certain role, a subservient role, you said. Was mm-hmm. there other characters you became as well?
I think I was. I mean, when I saw this Super 8 footage, I was very surprised at how, you know, like I said, I just looked like a little kid and was acting like one. And I had a pretty kind of closeted, is that the word, upbringing.
Like, right.
My wife will tell me about things, you know, she was doing at 12 and 15. And I was like, you know, in my world, like, it would be shocking, you know, to be doing such things. I don't want to throw my wife. Well, just normal.
Is it suffice to say what was normal in California was not normal in Northwest or Northeast or South England at the time, right?
Right. I can understand that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like a different planet. My parents are ultra conservative and so on. So I, you know, I think I was, you know, I had very sheltered upbringing. So I was thrown into this, you know, rock and roll lifestyle. You know, it was great. It was, you know, it was amazing fun. You know, when we were that age, you know, it was like being in a gang, and you were all, and we had a lot of, we were slagged off by the music press. It was vicious, and it was really terrible, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So that made us kind of have our backs to the wall, and we're like, you know, we're going to make it, and we'll show them. And
yeah,
it gave us that kind of attitude. So it really kind of pulled us all together. So you're like this gang, but within that gang, you know, when the split of the band came up with Bauhaus the first time around, or, you know, after we'd done four albums, I didn't see it coming at all. Right. It was pretty much a complete shock to me. Hmm. But, you know, the rest of the guys, you know, this thing had been brewing and very much in their, you know, front of their minds. And I remember we had a meeting at a rehearsal room, and it was just to kind of split up. And I was driving back. My brother was, I was giving him a lift, vice versa. And he was like, oh, thank God, I'm so relieved. And I was just like thinking the exact opposite. I'm just like in shock and like, what am I going to do now? And I can't believe this has happened. And because, you know, it defined my whole, you know, and that's another thing when you have some degree of success and fame, you know, that it defines you very much. You know, I'm the drummer in Bauhaus, and we're a great effing band, you know, we're unique, and we've broken down barriers, and, you know, it was so exciting and so great, and just to be, and it was so creative and all the rest that goes with it. And then suddenly, you know, it ends, and you're like, so I think I was a bit kind of head in the clouds.
Do you look back and think of yourself as, I certainly did, the court jester? Let me throw a theory out. It's just come to me. I've not been thinking about this, but I wonder, is it me that decided to be the court jester? Because I see an instance that I just cited when I was the one who was pretty serious, serious young man.
Right.
I've seen early footage of you, Lol, with Simon and Robert, where when asked a question to the three of you, you were the one who was most determined to give a succinct answer to that question, whilst the other two were kind of going, this guy's an idiot.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And they were being like children, and you were like carrying the mantle. And I'm thinking, well, that's no court jester role. But was it a role that was then devised in a way out of your own natural exuberance and playfulness? And our role as drummers is to blend and listen to everybody and make sure we sound like a band. I don't know. Is there kind of a commonality between the thinking that drummers need to have and think of Keith Moon, court jester, John Bonham, good drinker?
Yeah, it's true. I think also here's the other part of it, because you pointed it out very much. A lot of the times when you know, that spotlight is put on people, it can make them uncomfortable. So therefore, they look to diffuse it with humor, but then the humor becomes not quite so funny, and then it becomes a little bit more regimented and a little bit, you know, destructive, because it was in the case of The Cure, for sure. It became quite destructive. And
that sounds like you mean the court jester, if you like, becomes the scapegoat.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the thing that happened was, you know, there's lots of things, if I look at it, that I know that, you know, I know my part in things, but I also know that at a certain point, yes, the scapegoat thing, not a great idea for most people anyway, because, you know, the idea of the scapegoat, as soon as you're driven out, you imagine that all the problems are going to go. And that certainly didn't happen that certainly didn't happen. You know, like problems were still there, but just, you know, they had to have a different focus at that point. So I think now, knowing what I know, that it would be a completely different kind of reaction to things, and it would be a lot more loving. But we were very young guys who didn't really know how to deal with anything, you know, least what was going on with us success wise and that. And so it became like Lord of the Flies, you know, and it wasn't really that great. I always think, when you think about, you know, the court jester part, it's like, you know, in Shakespeare, like with King Lear, right? And King Lear's on the moor at night, you know, going nuts, right? And the jester, the fool, is there with him. But if you read into it all, in the end, it's like, you know, the fool is really just this other side of King Lear. You know, it's like his other personality, and it's the yin and yang, you know, without getting too airy-fairy, but it's the balance of things, you know? And a band, like everything else, needs a balance, I guess. You know, but the balance gets thrown out because it's like... One of Robert's favorite books was Cocteau's Les Enfants Terribles, you know, with the three of them stuck in this room forever and ever and ever. And it doesn't end well in the book, and it certainly doesn't end well if you put that into, you know, a band situation. It's very unnatural, in other words, the band.
It's very, very, very like a band, actually. That is like with a very, very much a kind of almost incestuous and privilege.
Yeah.
And then they turn it on one person.
Yes.
Yeah. Very much like Lord of the Flies, and old poor Piggy gets
pushed off the cliff.
The brunt of everything. Right. Yeah. Who were you rooting for? Piggy.
Yeah.
I'm finding this really beneficial for my memoir, because I guess, you know, there's places you don't really want to go back to, and feelings you don't want to dig up again. And this is starting to bring up, you know, a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling. And but I'm glad we're talking about this, because it's going to make me like dig a bit deeper than I wouldn't even consider doing.
Right.
But I think that's what one needs to be doing.
It's what's required. It's what's required to set yourself free, you know, really.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I can understand that. Yeah. Were you there was another role I've remembered I took on, was like the peacekeeper.
Oh.
I was like, you know, the youngest. I was kind of an easy target because of that. And I took on the role of like the jester, and I would do funny things. I thought, well, it's my job to be entertaining, you know, make people laugh. But I was also a peacekeeper. I would be
diffuse,
like, you know, neutral territory. Were you guys, was that the same with you, or can you relate to that?
I was the bomb disposal specialist. To diffuse the situation with least collateral damage. I don't know if I was any good at it. But yeah, it wasn't, I didn't have to particularly side in any way, but that was my natural inclination, was to bring things together. That's why I mentioned the role as our role as drummers. It's kind of giving a firm footing for the vocalist, whilst taking into consideration the bass player's lack of desire to do the same thing, you know, or wanting to but not able to, and making sure the guitarist sounds great even though they're nowhere near us, you know. It's kind of you're pulling all these elements together, and that requires empathy with everybody, whilst maintaining a surety of what my role is, and it fluctuates.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that. I mean, I I'm absolutely certain, and I don't say this out of any pomposity or anything, but without my various ministries, I guess, to various people, and that the band would have fallen apart several times completely and not, you know, returned in any shape or form. And so, yeah, I was good at keeping things together for people. You know, I didn't really have a relationship of any import with my father, you know. And so when the band started, that was like my, not my dad, but it was my family. It became my family, you know. And I was, it was like, yeah, it's like, you know, you see young guys that go into gangs, you know, that don't have, you know, families or whatever, and that, and they, that becomes their family. And so it was definitely, you know, The Cure was my family. So in that way, you know, most families have people in the families that occupy different roles, and a band is no different, you know? But I actually feel that by writing it all down and reliving some of it and understanding it, it is the sort of, it's not brave, because, you know, brave is people going down a coal mine, you know, but and I couldn't do that, but you know, it's,
that was the option we had.
Yeah,
I remember.
Yeah.
My school days were like, what are you going to do, work in the glass factory or go down the pit?
Right. Oh geez. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's about, in the end, you know, what is it? I was trying to find this quote last night because somebody reminded me of it, about Allen Ginsberg, you know, like, hey, you know, life's not the journey, it's the trip, right? It is the trip, you know. You got to get in to understanding, you know, like, and what was the other one he said about getting in with the moonshine, letting the madness out? I've horribly mangled that quote, but it's, you get the idea. It's about, you know, don't hide who you are, because this is the chance we get to be who we are, you know. And it's valid, you know. It's like that whole thing, the imposter syndrome, you know. You start to feel that you're somehow, you weren't supposed to be who you are, which is kind of nonsense if you think about it, you know. Of course we were supposed to be who we are.
I did film and TV scoring for like 10 years. You know, I had some notable moments, and I joined up with a guy, Doug DeAngelis, and we worked as a team and did some, you know, a few notable things. But one, after a while, we went separate ways because I was doing Bauhaus again. And I got to score this film. And in, you know, when you start a film, you have a spotting session where you sit with the director and producers, and you look at the film and you decide where music's needed and why it's needed. And at the end, the director said, yeah, you know, I'm really feeling now, I'm really feeling that this needs a big orchestral score. And inside, I learned quite quickly that you don't really, if you have any negative thoughts, you don't verbalize them.
Right.
You're like, you always say, yeah, I can do that. Yeah. And then you figure it out. So I didn't say anything, and I got back to my studio, and I was just like, what the hell am I going to do? And I was pacing around my studio for a couple of hours and freaking out, and then the word delegate came into my head. So I called up a friend of a friend, and he introduced me to a cello player, and he introduced me to an orchestrator and this guy, and I met with him, and he, you know, so I started writing stuff as best I could. And I was just in the deep end, and I was way out of my depth. And as we went along, I decided to give the orchestrator, I said, do you want to just score this with me? You know, of course, he was over the moon. He said, yeah, yeah. We're like, we'll just take an equal credit. And you take on the heavy work, you know. Right. So at the end, we had my scenes written out and, you know, like on these huge long pieces of notation paper with
right.
Everything written out, you know, and I went along to the recording session, And I felt like an imposter. And then the orchestrator said, it's customary for you to come in and be introduced to the orchestra. So I went in the studio. It's like, ladies and gentlemen, this is Kevin Huskins. He's the composer on the film. And they all clapped. And at that point, I felt like the biggest imposter in the world. Like, like if they only knew, I thought. So I just kind of played along like I was in this weird dream or movie and that I didn't belong in. And so when they started playing, I was like, I could count bars. Right. So I was just counting the bars. And I did hear one mistake with the cellos. I thought somebody slipped up there. And it was like bar 89 or something. So they got through it. And I said everything, because I was like, everything okay? And I'd be usually like, yeah, I guess. And I was like, can we go to bar 89? And there was a little error.
Wow.
I felt so proud of myself. I was like, okay. That made me feel a little bit better.
Because did you see the cellist afterwards and say, thanks for messing up on bar 89?
What I wanted to ask was the next day, did you walk in with, you know, a cape on and a stick and a hat and stuff, you know, the composer? Yeah.
Well, it's been fantastic.
Lovely.
Lovely. Well, it's been very nice and very good.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.